Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Les plateformes de formation en réalité virtuelle, comme ForgeFX, permettent aux élèves en soudure de développer les compétences nécessaires pour débuter et faire évoluer leur carrière. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
I'm Lise Doucette with the Global Story Podcast. Today, we have rare access to Sudan, a country, entire communities, millions of lives torn apart by a devastating war, a war which many Sudanese believe the world has forgotten or is just ignoring. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from our BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Qureshi, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 20th of March, these are our main stories.
Everything bad. No hospital. No job. Nothing good in Haiti. Nothing.
Haiti descends into even greater despair amid warnings there has never been a worse crisis.
This is worse than Duvalier.
It's worse than during the dictatorship
of Duvalier.
A Supreme Court setback for the Biden administration over illegal migrant crossings from Mexico. And Brazil's COVID skeptic ex-president is formally accused of falsifying vaccine records. Also in this podcast, a top American official warns Ukraine's fight against Russia mustn't be allowed to fail. And
I'm afraid they're quite ill-behaved.
I always think behaviour is a matter of handling.
Yes, I'm sure you do.
British actor Ewan McGregor calls in the intimacy coordinator to help with the sex scenes in his latest drama with his real-life wife. The UN's Children's Agency has described the state of Haiti as horrific. Similar, she said, to the lawlessness of the post-apocalyptic Mad Max movies. The gangs which have seized Haiti's streets have now taken control of the Caribbean country's money. Several people were killed as police pushed back an assault on the central bank building in the capital. And the concern doesn't end there. The UN is warning of famine and malnutrition and the near collapse of basic services. So just how dire is the situation? Our correspondent, Will Grant, sent this report from the northern coastal city of Cap Haitien.
The main thoroughfares in Cap Haitien capture the sense of some of the chaos of this country. Potholed streets and piles of rubbish which have been set on fire. Goats wandering in amongst the market sellers. The thing is, Haiti isn't like this because of the current crisis. It's always like this. And this is currently probably its safest city.
Haitian situation, everything bad. No hospital, no job, no good market, you know. Nothing good in Haiti. Nothing. Not real government too.
But the situation is terrible for us because I got family help there. As human beings, we're not supposed to be in this situation. We are like fighting with each other. That's not supposed to happen in any country.
Drive down any of the main roads from here to the capital, Port-au-Prince, and on numerous occasions you'll be stopped by armed gang members at makeshift checkpoints demanding money. Haiti's problems, grinding poverty and political instability, haven't necessarily been caused by the gangs, but they've been seriously exacerbated by them.
Will Grant reporting from Cap Haitien. So, who can rescue Haiti from the depths? Earlier this month, as the acting Prime Minister Ariel Henry resigned, the regional grouping of Caribbean countries, CARICOM, announced a plan to set up what's called a transitional presidential council, which in turn would appoint a new prime minister and a government. There's been a tremendous amount of bickering and politicking over who should be on that council. One of the eight names to have been put forward so far is Leslie Voltaire, an urban planner who was a minister under the former Prime Minister Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He spoke to Tim Franks.
We are in a very dire situation. I know there is danger. I have been in danger already. because I was the Minister of Education for President Aristide. We went to exile and we had like two coups d'etat. We know the problem in Haiti and we have to do something because now all the ports are blocked. The airport is blocked. Even if you want to go to the beach, you cannot go. To the mountain, you cannot go. There is a lot of kidnapping, rape, a lot of burglary. One has to decide if you want to live like that or if you want to fight. I want to fight.
Strong words. You say you want to fight. I mean, there are those very powerful men with guns, the gang leaders, who have said that they totally reject the authority of this council, and they've issued pretty clear threats to people like you who want to say that you know where the country should go next.
We know that, and this is the danger. But those bandits cannot govern. They say that they have put Ariel Henry out, but they cannot enter into the palace, into the prime minister's office. They are talking about revolution, but those are thugs and criminals, and we cannot let Haiti being ruled by criminals.
Do you fear for your safety?
Yes, I fear for my safety. My wife reminds me every hour that I put her in danger, but it's like being kidnapped in my house, or when I go to another house, it's like being kidnapped, so I don't see that we can live like that.
At the moment, are you saying that it's not safe enough for the members of the Transitional Council to meet in person?
No. We have done a lot of Zoom meeting, Google Meet and WhatsApp, but it is not safe to go to a restaurant or to go to a hotel or public space to meet.
Well, given that you're up against these incredibly powerful gangs who've got no interest in order being restored, I mean, I just wonder what you really think you can achieve.
I think those powerful guys, they have masters in the private sector, in the political sector. They have masters in the international sector. I think with dialogue, we can integrate them into a lot of seats in the communities, in the ministries, in the agencies. If we create a civic corps for young people that have not been very participating in those gangs, they will integrate that corps. I think there are a lot of formula, but the fish pourri par la tête. The fish rots from the head, and that fish is rotten. So we need a new head, because security begins by the head.
Just one last question. Have you ever seen Haiti in the state that it currently is?
Never. I didn't plan that for my old ages. This is worse than Duvalier.
It's worse than during the dictatorship
of
Duvalier.
Well,
Leslie Voltaire speaking to Tim Franks. The US Supreme Court has given the go-ahead to a controversial and criticised law that is set to allow state police in Texas to arrest and deport people who have crossed illegally into the US via the southern border. Neighbouring Mexico has condemned the law as anti-immigrant. I spoke to our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
The law is still subject to legal review in a lower court, but for now, at least, it means that police officers in the state of Texas will be able to arrest and prosecute migrants suspected of illegally crossing the Mexican border. Now, enforcing immigration laws, including arrests, has typically been handled by the federal government. This law now gives that power to Texan officials, allowing them to prosecute migrants or order them returned to Mexico. Although reacting to this, a senior Mexican official has said that Mexico's government will not accept migrants who Texas state officials attempt to deport under this law. Joe Biden is not happy. The Biden administration had asked the court to put this law on hold while it challenged the measure in the lower courts. That process is continuing with a hearing scheduled at a U.S. Court of Appeals on April the 3rd. The White House argues that the law violates the U.S. Constitution and federal law by interfering with the government's power. That's the federal government's power to regulate immigration. The argument against that from Texas, and we've heard from the Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, who's described the decision as a huge win. He says it's about defending Texas and its sovereignty, the state's ability to make its own decisions.
No coincidence then, perhaps, this is relatively good news for the Republicans in election year.
Well, of course, this is hugely political. In fact, that's illustrated by the divide on the Supreme Court. The three liberal justices all dissented from this decision, one of them saying that the law would upend the long-standing federal-state balance of power and sow chaos. But yes, clearly it's going to be a huge election issue. It has been ever since Donald Trump first came to power.
Peter Bowes. It's the big question of the war in Ukraine. Will President Zelensky's forces have enough weapons and ammunition to keep Russia at bay? At an airbase in Germany, about 50 allies supporting Kiev have been meeting to discuss the needs for more support. Lloyd Austin, the US Defence Secretary, promised Washington would not let Ukraine fail.
Today, Ukraine's survival is in danger. And America's security is at risk. And they don't have a day to waste. And we don't have a day to spare either. So I leave here today fully determined to keep U.S. security assistance and ammunition flowing. And it's a matter of honor and security for America. And make no mistake, Putin is watching, the world is watching, and history is watching.
Our correspondent, Jessica Parker, in Berlin, has been following that news conference. I started by asking, how was Lloyd Austin able to make these promises despite Republicans in Congress currently blocking a massive military aid package for Kyiv?
Lloyd Austin is trying to reassure allies that the will is there. So we know a $60 billion aid package to Ukraine is stuck in Congress. And he's talked as well about $300 million they've managed to source as a sort of one-off fund to help Ukraine with its defence and its security. But look, I mean, I think this was a bit of a difficult balance for Lloyd Austin, you know, with this aid package stuck and with all that uncertainty as well around the US elections and what change that might mean. He is trying to reassure allies, but at the same time, people I speak to here in Europe are very much saying they are looking at what they need to do in Europe to become more self-sufficient.
And Lloyd Austin seemed to give his approval to this Czech initiative for shells.
Yes, so the Czechs have proposed going beyond borders of the EU to look for artillery shell ammunition supplies, because a lot of the discussion has been in Europe about we need to ramp up our own domestic industrial base. But some nations are coming very far behind in doing that. But what the Czechs are saying is let's pull cash together and or look to third countries outside of the EU in order to try and get that desperately needed ammunition to Ukraine.
Jessica Parker. When the former Brazilian president Jair Bolsonaro was in office during the COVID pandemic, he was one of the few world leaders who spoke out publicly against the vaccine and encouraged society to do the same. He also promoted unproven treatments. Well, now Brazilian police have formally indicted him of fraud relating to his COVID vaccination records. He'd been under investigation since last year. Our South America correspondent Ione Wells, who's in Sao Paulo, told me more.
What they have said is that even though he publicly claimed many times that he had not had a COVID vaccine and he said that he was very much against having a COVID vaccine, they say that his health records show that he said that he did have one. And why that was significant is that would have meant that he would have been able to, for example, travel to the US at a time when foreign visitors needed to have had a COVID vaccine. Now, he has denied this and said that he has not tampered with any of his COVID vaccination records. But what police have said today is that they have enough evidence to formally accuse him. This could mean now that the Attorney General's office in Brazil is going to essentially decide whether to formally charge him, in which case he could well face further criminal proceedings.
All very interesting, this, isn't it?
That's right. Certainly, this is just one of a kind of number of investigations that the former president is facing. I think what's really interesting about this particular claim as well is that the Brazilian authorities have already actually said publicly as part of a separate investigation that his COVID vaccine records were false. They say that there was a number of different pieces of evidence to suggest this, including that the date he was claimed to have had it was actually not when he was in Sao Paulo. They also say that the nurse who was allegedly the person administering it has denied doing so. So there's already been various pieces of evidence found to suggest that the documents were false. He has said, which is something he's repeatedly claimed, that this is part of a sort of political stitch-up, but he has said when it comes to this particular investigation that he is, in his words, calm, and that he kind of has repeated that he didn't receive the vaccine. So there is this irregularity here where his public health records say that he did. He claims that he didn't, but he also claims he didn't have any role in tampering with Brazil's National Health Service as about his health and medical history.
Ione Wells in Sao Paulo. A 39-year-old man has become the first person in England and Wales to be jailed for cyber flashing, an offence created by the Online Safety Act. Nicholas Hawkes was sentenced to a year in prison at a Crown Court in London for sending unsolicited explicit photos to a 15-year-old girl and a woman. The move has been widely welcomed by campaigners. Justin Webb spoke to Emily Atack, actor, presenter and campaigner, and Zoe Billingham, a former police inspector. First, we hear from Emily, who made a TV documentary specifically about what happened to her.
I named my documentary Asking For It, which is an awful slogan that women have had thrown at them our entire lives. And it was a particular look at the online space and cyber flashing and the ripple effect that's had on my life, my family's life. It was something that I was kind of suffering with in silence, not knowing if this was happening to anybody else. And I found the more I spoke about it, the more I realised what a huge issue this was.
To people who haven't seen it, it was staggering the level of personal abuse and obscenity that you personally were subjected to.
Yeah, I started to talk about it in like a humorous way to kind of get attention on it. But the fact was, I was receiving these messages, and I'm talking thousands and thousands a day from different men, from images, videos. I found that it was really kind of chipping away, questioning my entire being, everything I was as a woman. Why does this happen to me? I'm a particular type of woman that this happens to. So when you hear people talking about a change in law, I welcome it with open arms, because the issue around cyber flashing and sexual violence generally is that there are these constant supposed grey areas. These behaviours have been normalised since the beginning of time, and that is something that we really need to look at. Change in law is one thing, but it's about having society on your side to say, no, this is a crime, it is wrong, not just so that somebody is punished for it, but so that it changes people's mindsets on it and it unpicks a really systemic problem that's been going on for a long time, and taking these supposed normalised behaviours and saying that they are absolutely unacceptable and they cause long-lasting psychological harm.
I've been talking to Zoe Billingham, former Inspectorate of Constabulary. We started just with the overall significance of the court case, the sentencing and what it signifies.
I think it's a really important day. It's a demonstration of the state's intent to tackle violence against women and girls and to take crimes against them absolutely seriously. This is no laughing matter, Justin. This absolutely needs to be dealt with as a serious sexual offence. The police are already investing significant resources into making sure that they can track down offenders of these crimes. And the prevalence is eye-watering, isn't it? You know, the idea that 3 out of 4 of our listeners' daughters between the ages 12 and 18 will receive an unsolicited nude picture. I mean, it's just extraordinary. It's become normalised.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? I suppose one of the questions is whether a piece of legislation like this actually changes the minds of those girls and says to them, no, you don't have to just put up with this.
We hope that this legislation will, of and in itself, empower women to say, no, this is not normal. I shouldn't be being humiliated in my tube journey to school. I shouldn't be receiving these unsolicited pictures of boys and men. I should be able to say no. And when I step forward to the police, they should be taking my complaints seriously.
Zoe Billingham, a former police inspector of constabulary, and before that, actor Emily Atack. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
The buildings have decorative screens to shield the sun. They're long and thin, often one room thick, so that they can be cross-ventilated by the sea breeze.
African architecture takes centre stage at a new exhibition in the UK called Tropical Modernism. With just over 4 months to Paris 2024, Olympics officials meeting in Switzerland have announced that Russian and Belarusian athletes competing at the Games under a neutral flag will not be able to take part in the opening ceremony. The International Olympic Committee has also called on governments around the world to boycott Russia's rival athletics competition known as the Friendship Games. Some very strong language then from the IOC, as I put to our sports news correspondent Laura Scott.
They've called out Russia for overtly politicising sport, something that they say is a blatant violation of the Olympic Charter. The Friendship Games isn't exactly a new event. The first one was held in 1984 after the boycott of the Olympics in Los Angeles. They're hoping that it's a commercial prospect for athletes around the world. They quite clearly want countries to send their athletes there, and it is in the few weeks after the Olympics finishes. And the IOC have called on governments and Olympic committees and federations to not send their athletes there. I asked them if they would consider any sanctions for anyone who does take part, and they said that they would have to look at that very closely indeed. So they're not ruling out sanctioning anyone who does take part.
When we talk about the Olympics and specifically the opening ceremony, what's happening there with regards Russian and Belarusian athletes?
Well, they've decided, the executive board of the International Olympic Committee, that Russian and Belarusian athletes won't be taking part in the opening ceremony at Paris. Now, this is a very unique opening ceremony. It involves a parade of boats up the River Seine. And they've said that those athletes who are neutral athletes in individual sports won't take part in that parade. They said that the logic to that is because these athletes aren't part of a team and therefore it wouldn't really be appropriate for them to take part in that parade. They have said that they'll invite them to enjoy the experience in some way, but we won't see them on the boats.
And they can participate in the games, but still under a neutral flag?
Exactly. It was announced in December that athletes from Russia and Belarus who qualify for the games can compete as neutrals. That's only in individual events. No teams from Russia and Belarus will take part. They said that so far there are 12 individual neutral athletes with a Russian passport and 7 individual neutral athletes with a Belarusian passport who've qualified so far of the 6,000 quota places already awarded.
Laura Scott. Google's artificial intelligence division DeepMind has created a prototype AI football coaching assistant to help teams improve their performance. The programme, Tactic AI, was developed in collaboration with the English Premier League club Liverpool. Here's Danny Eberhard.
Elite sport is big business, and increasingly big data helps give an edge. Football fans might not care for the algorithms, but if it means their teams defend corners better, they'll no doubt swallow the encroachment on the game's romance. DeepMind focused on corners partly because they and other set pieces account for about a third of goals, but also because they start from a fixed point. The company says Tactic AI analysed thousands of real corners and suggested tweaks to defenders' positioning. In blind tests, it says, real human experts at Liverpool preferred the AI positioning in 90% of scenarios. Such innovations, it says, could revolutionise sport and be applied to fields ranging from robotics to traffic control. But analysing the dynamism of open play remains a challenge, even for AI, so the likes of Jurgen Klopp or Pep Guardiola won't be out of a job just yet.
Danny Eberhard there. Now, here's a question. Are bears becoming a problem in the Eastern European country of Slovakia? And does there need to be a change of regulations so that bears can be hunted and culled? Well, last weekend, two people needed medical treatment after a bear was seen bounding through the northern town of Liptovský Mikuláš. The attack came a day after a Belarusian woman apparently fell to her death as she fled a bear in the nearby Low Tatra Mountains. Authorities are now trying to kill the bear and have told residents to avoid the forest. Jana Kabisova is a journalist covering the environment at actuality.sk, the Slovak news website, and she spoke to Tim Franks.
Slovakia has the privilege to have bears because our neighbor countries, they almost don't have any bears because they killed their population. We have brown bears. They don't attack people normally, just only if they are scared. And most cases of incidents between bears and humans were because bears were protecting their babies. People should change their behavior about bears because we have problems with waste, which is available for bears.
What you're saying is that there should be greater focus on sort of preventing the interaction between humans and bears. One of the things that the government is looking at, from what I understand, is whether the laws about the hunting and the killing of bears should be changed, whether the rules should be loosened.
Well, we have in our government people were sharing hoaxes about bears, and now they are not able to solve problems about bear population according to facts and scientific information. They are trying to solve it by gun, which is the last option to shoot the bears. And they are even trying to make pressure on the European Commission to reclassify bear into another category of protection so that they will be able to regulate bear population more radically than it is now, because now bear is protected in our country by national and also by EU law, but they can shoot the problematic ones.
Bears are still on the endangered species list. How is the population doing in Slovakia?
We have population in a good condition. The bears are able to have more babies and the population is rising, but not so exponential. We should focus on that, how to live with these protected animals in symbiosis, not to kill them all, because this political situation is leading to eliminate all the bears.
Jana Kibiseva speaking to Tim Franks. Well, now, it's easy to see why actors would want someone to navigate awkward sex scenes on set. But what if the actors are both married? The Scottish actor Ewan McGregor said it was still necessary in his latest series, A Gentleman in Moscow, despite him starring opposite his wife, Mary Elizabeth Winstead. He said it's also about the crew and it's odd to be naked in front of people. It's odd to be intimate in front of the camera.
She's an actress.
Ah.
I've seen her films. They're not very good.
I'm afraid they're quite ill-behaved.
I always think behaviour is a matter of handling.
Yes, I'm sure you do.
The trailer for the adaptation of Amor Towles' novel is streaming on Paramount Plus from March the 29th. Intimacy coordinator Robbie Taylor-Hunt has worked on big dramas, including Sky Atlantic's Mary and George, Netflix's You, and the BBC's Everything I Know About Love. He told Sarah Montague more about the importance of his role.
The intimacy coordinators are there to help make what is ultimately quite a personal thing to have to do, a professional process. So actually, when we're talking about married couples, there's even more risk, really, of muddying the water between the personal and professional, that people don't take it as seriously, or they're a bit more kind of casual and personal with them because they go, oh, you already know each other, so you're fine, sort of thing. Whereas actually, they're still having to do the incredibly intimate and slightly awkward thing of performing an act of simulated sex together in a room full of crew and their colleagues. Although they might feel a bit more comfortable, there's still a process there that needs to be treated properly.
I suppose as well, they could be being asked to do things in this scene which they might not normally do, as she said delicately.
Exactly, yeah. We don't know anything about that real couple's intimate life. And so to assume that, like, oh, you'll be okay doing this type of sex act is adding assumptions and making kind of personal comment on those actors' lives.
You're a sort of choreographer, aren't you? Are you advising people where to put their hands? I mean, how detailed does it become?
It can be about giving kind of containers of what it is and what it's not, what the kind of journey through the intimacy should be. Or we can be really specific and really choreograph each beat, be very clear with what the motions are, where hands go at what moments. But when it comes to simulated sex as well, ultimately you're trying to make something that's not happening look like it's happening, like with staged violence. And we have equipment, we have kit, we have modesty garments and all sorts of tricks of the trade to help make these things feel repeatable and safe for the performers, but realistic and creative and dynamic and characterful and exciting for the performers and then the audience.
So are sex scenes better now that intimacy coordinators are involved?
Absolutely, yeah. I think when people are comfortable and when the director feels more able to have these conversations frankly with an intimacy coordinator support, when the actors can really feel supported, they give better performances because they're going, great, I can really go for it. I can really find what I think my character needs because I know I have this professional overseeing the whole process.
We're talking about Ewan McGregor and his second wife who met on the film set Fargo. There are famous cases of actors falling in love and, of course, presumably intimate scenes hastening that process.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. So within intimacy practice, we talk about closure practice. So because when we're potentially naked with someone, our body is still skin-to-skin contact with someone and actually kissing them. So that does a certain thing to a kind of physiological response. We're trying to allow it to have a kind of closure behind it to go, right, let's not let that spill into your lunch break. It's for like, oh, good, we worked on that together and goodbye. We can go back to being colleagues now.
Really? So what, you advise people in a way to stop them falling in love?
We're all very happy for people to fall in love generally. But part of that closure practice is just helping someone keep a sort of professional scope to the intimate scene they worked on.
I bet the husband or wife at home love you.
Yeah, I hadn't quite thought about that actually, but I suppose they would be grateful for us.
Robbie Taylor-Hunt speaking to Sarah Montague. Tropical Modernism is a new exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum here in London. It looks at how in the 1950s architecture in Ghana changed as Britain's African colonies asserted their own identity. And it shows how those changes helped pave the way towards independence, as Vincent Dowd reports.
Citizens of the new state of Ghana gather for the celebration marking their day of freedom from colonialism.
It's an exhibition about buildings and politics.
Mark an event of historic importance.
It looks at India as well, but at the centre of the exhibition is Ghana becoming the first sub-Saharan African nation to become independent of Britain. Christopher Turner of the V&A Museum in London.
After the Second World War, when so many colonial troops had been in action, there were increasing calls for independence, and this was supported by America. The British Colonial Office advocated a philosophy of gradualism, and they poured a lot of money into programs to build schools, universities, supposedly to prepare the colonies for eventual self-government, really to try and offset calls for independence.
Yet on March the 6th, 1957, independence came, with Kwame Nkrumah as Ghana's leader. The new show evokes the pride and excitement of that moment.
Ghana, land of freedom, toils of the brave, and the sweat of their labours.
Modernist architecture after World War II had been the work of white architects, above all of the British couple Maxwell Fry and Jane Drew. That did not change overnight, but President Nkrumah wanted to see African designers at work too, such as John Owusu-Addo, who's now 95.
We were more or less the first generation of trained architects. Whatever building was put up, Nkrumah wanted it to be in line with the most modern trends. He wanted Ghana to be a showpiece for Africa and the world.
Christopher Turner says the exhibition shows European modernism adapted for Africa. The results, he says, were practical and attractive.
The buildings have decorative screens to shield the sun. They're long and thin, often one room thick, so that they can be cross-ventilated by the sea breeze. They have wide overhanging eaves to create shade, and the colonial circumstance allowed for the invention of this style.
Dr. Nkrumah went out his way to make the Gold Coast what it is today. He endeavoured continually to bring us freedom and liberty.
Kwame Nkrumah lost power in a coup in 1966. Samia Nkrumah is his daughter.
Even before independence, he started thinking, he and his colleagues at the government, of how Ghana would build itself as an independent nation. That quest for self-reliance, hospitals, factories, everything to do with nation building had to express new identity, gradually expressing ourselves as we become stronger and more economically confident.
Tropical modernism changed the look of parts of Ghana's cities, but Professor John Owusu-Addo regrets that today its influence is all but gone.
Diminished and almost vanished. And you can see high-rise buildings in Accra now. And instead of building to see the traffic, you see buildings wrapped in glass from Europe and America, produced mostly by foreigners.
The new exhibition isn't only about global architecture. It's an introduction to the politics of independence and to the huge changes Africa has seen in the last 7 decades.
Vincent Dowd with that report. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Qureshi. Until next time, goodbye.
I'm Pleased to Set with the Global Story podcast. Today, we have rare access to Sudan, a country, entire communities, millions of lives torn apart by a devastating war, a war which many Sudanese believe the world has forgotten or is just ignoring. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from our BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.